Bless your word. You inspired it, preserved it, and gave it to us. Now, Lord, give us wisdom and discernment in the scriptures. In thy name we pray. Amen. All right. Now, if you'll go back to the book of Genesis with me this morning, please. Chapter 5. Now, of course, what you're reading in Genesis predates history. When I say that, I'm talking about secular history. When you get back as far as the book of Genesis chapters 5 and 6, you get into the world of pagan mythology. They don't have a clue. They don't have a clue. But the book of Genesis, being the inspired record of history that God told Moses to write, is an entirely different situation. So in Genesis chapter number 5, we have a genealogy. We have genealogies that lead up to chapter number 6. Now, the reason these genealogies are included here is because the writer, Moses, is preparing you for what's about to take place in the last few verses of chapter number 6. For he tells you of an invasion that takes place in chapter 6 and verse number 2. So the genealogy of chapter number 5 is very important because we can trace two separate, completely separate genealogies or lines of people that come forth from Adam. One is the line of Cain, the other is the line of Seth. And of course we know Abel was murdered by his brother Cain, and his name means transitory. He was here for a while, then he was gone. And Hebrews talks about that, and a number of other times in the Bible, references made back to Cain murdering Abel. But in Genesis chapter number 5, it says in verse 1, "The book of the generations of Adam, in the day that God created man, in the likeness of God created he him. Male and female created he them, blessed them, and called their name Adam." Now, what does that mean? Pardon? Mankind, exactly. That means mankind. The word Adam is a generic name, like man is a generic name. You know, what if your parents had called you man? See, you'd be confused all the time. You know, every time somebody used the word man, you'd think they was talking about you. So man is a generic term. It simply refers to a whole classification. So does Adam. But Adam also becomes the personal name of the first man that was made. The Bible said the first man, Adam, was of the earth, earthy. The last man is the Lord from heaven. See the difference. So here we have a genealogy. And the genealogy, they have the names listed. And these names all have specific meanings, every last one of them. I've given you this before, but let's go through it quickly. I'm not going to take a whole lot of time with this because I've got a lot of ground to cover today. But if you'll notice, the name Adam starts here in chapter number 5, and it says, called his name Adam. That Adam means mankind. All right, that's what it means. And then he bore a son, called him Seth, verse number 3. Seth means appointed. Then in verse number 9, another son is born, and his name is Enos. And that name means mortal or frail. Then we have in verse number 9 another one, and his name is Canaan. That name means sorrow or dirge or gloom. And then we have in verse number 13, Canaan lived, he begat Mahalalel. That name means blessed or praised. And then chapter number 5 and verse number 15, we have Jared. That name means shall come down or shall come from above. Then in verse number 18, we have Enoch, and that name means initiation. And something strange is said about Enoch of no one else in the Bible. What was that? Walked with God. God took him, right? And he becomes a picture, the type of the church. Then in verse number 21, we have Methuselah. Methuselah. And each one of these are being named because of a prophecy that is developing during this period of time. The name Methuselah means that his death, when he is dead, it shall come, or his death shall bring forth something. His death is associated with some event. And then in chapter number 5 and verse 25, Methuselah lived and begat Lamech. His name means to lament or despair. And then finally, chapter 5, verse 29, we have Noah. And that name means to rest or comfort or relief. So if we put these names together, starting with chapter number 5 and finish up with Noah, here's what it says. It says, Adam, man, is appointed Seth as a mortal being Cain to sorrow. Mahalalel, the blessed God, shall come down, Jared. Teaching, his death shall bring, Methuselah, the despairing comfort and rest. Isn't that amazing? Now, that's not an arbitrary thing. In other words, it's not a contrived thing where you force Scripture to say what you want it to and arrange names in the fashion you want them to. That's the way the names are arranged. And when you look at the meanings, that's the message you get. One more time. Man appointed mortal sorrow, but the blessed God shall come down, teaching that his death shall bring the despairing comfort and rest. And that's exactly what happened. For when our Lord Jesus Christ showed up, he brought rest, because our rest is no longer in doing, our rest is in a person. And the Hebrews makes a big deal about that, because rest is a big issue in the book of Hebrews. And our rest is in Christ. Our rest is not in a thing, not in doing, not in a place, but in a person. Therefore, the Sabbath to us is the Lord Jesus Christ. He is the Sabbath of rest. Now, here in subtitle C-11, section 2521, the National Medical Device Registry states, the Secretary shall establish a National Medical Device Registry in this subsection referred to as the Registry to facilitate analysis of post-market safety and outcomes data on each device that A, is or has been used in or on a patient, B, is a Class 3 device or a subsection under that, a Class 2 device that is implantable. The language is deliberately vague, but it provides the structure for making America the first nation in the world that would require every U.S. citizen to receive an implanted radio frequency microchip for the purpose of controlling medical care. In other words, Obamacare has hidden within its pages the possibility that you could be given a RFID chip. As Nancy Pelosi says, vote for it, then you can read it and find out what's in it. Does the Bible call somebody like that a fool? But in any event, that's what's coming, 2013. That kind of cheers you up when November shows up and the election comes, doesn't it? Because Romney says the first act he'll do when he goes into office is repeal Obamacare. Yes, sir. I know it. And it's a huge document. But you can be certain of this. Marxist socialist wrote it in their philosophy. That's right. It's Marxism, socialism. Yes, sir. Yeah, socialistic medicine in Great Britain. You don't want what's going on in Great Britain, because people over there are dying because they can't get treatment. They have to wait so long to get it. It's there for them, but the problem is it's not available for them. You see, ostensibly they have it. It's written down in the code. They can have it, but the practical application is they can't get to them, and so they die. And that's what's going to happen in this country when you socialize medicine. There's a problem with medical care, folks. There is a real problem. And the Republicans have sat up there and done nothing about it for decades. And the Democrats, the same. It's something that has gotten to the point now to where the Democrats are using it, you know, to garner support. Because surely you're compassionate enough to understand that people need care. Well, they do. And health care is completely off the chart. It's ridiculous at how high it's gone. It's unbelievable. Listen, folks, you get sick. If you don't have health insurance, you're bankrupt. Period. You're finished. They'll wipe out every dime you've got. Take everything you have. Now, why in the world would you let a system like that develop in your country? The people that you elected into office, the senators and the representatives that you sent to Washington, D.C. for decades, trusted them to look out for the welfare of their people, have not done the job. Republican and Democrat both. And Obama just stepped into the vacuum, and that's why this is happening. And so you need to find out what Romney intends to do. You know, he was the governor of Massachusetts, had Romney Care. He's had that thrown in his face a thousand times, which some say was the precursor of Obamacare. However much like Obamacare is, I don't know, because I haven't seen much critical analysis of it. But the bottom line is something's got to be done. And it's coming. It's coming quickly, folks. It's coming. But you don't want an RFID chip implanted in you, do you? Maybe it was Wednesday night when I told you how that a Saudi Arabian has invented a cyanide capsule that is attached to the RFID chip, where if you don't take the mark, or if you fall out of line with quick step and goose stepping with the Antichrist, they can push a button and you're dead. Yeah. That's quite a comforting thought, isn't it? To think that you've got a chip in you that all they got to do is push a button. Your history. You say, I won't come to that preacher. You got more faith in the government than I do. All right. Now let's go back to the giants. I've got some very interesting stuff for you this morning, folks. Very, very, as the old German said, very interesting. So as you begin to study these things, it's amazing how they continue to unfold. Let's just read something here that was sent to Stephen Quayle, the author of this book, Genesis. By the way, I've some folks mentioned said they couldn't get this. Well, I've found some places on the internet where you can find it. And it's available if you'd like to order that. I did a little snooping around to see if it might be in PDF format, but I couldn't find it. Well, it was in PDF format, but you had to pay for it. So, you know, it's not a freebie. But in any event, the man who wrote this book, Stephen Quayle, is a researcher, all right? And the bottom line is, if you want to find out what's going on, don't bother to go to the church. Forget that. You're not going to get it in the church house. You've got to go to these researchers. You've got to go to these people who have a sincere desire to dig up the truth and manifest it to people. Here's a letter from a U.S. military, Marines, reconnaissance that were in Iraq, Marine recon. They call them force recon. And these Marines over there have not just in isolated cases, but in quite a few cases have been running into some stuff over there. CBS, NBC, ABC, and the rest of them never reported it. But either this is a total fabrication or there's some truth in it. Listen carefully. After he explained to me what that entailed and some of the things he did in Iraq, which were incredible in themselves, as his team was in Saddam's palace, that they stumbled upon through networks of tunnels that was outside the city. Saddam was inside and they'd confirmation, but were told to stand down, return to base. Could have saved thousands of lives and avoided the war, but were told they were to confirm weapons of mass destructions and not take down Saddam. Sad. Anyhow, back to giants. I stopped him in telling me about his tours, 8 total between Iraq and Afghanistan, and said, I have a strange question to ask if I may. He obliged, and I straight up asked, do you know anything about giants? We're talking about a military, a Marine. His eyes lit up and his head dropped. Wow, he said. Did not expect that question. Yes, but I'm not supposed to ever talk about it. That figures. Then he opened up to me about it. He first heard tales in his training in Okinawa, but soon after shipped out, and the tales became first-hand experience for him. He told me stories of caves with pictographs, giants in coffins 8 to 12 feet tall, jewels, thousands of gold bars, and just insane stuff. He told me their orders were always one of two things. We melt everything down, or we have to, or told to leave and never go back or discuss locations. His gear always consisted of tracking equipment, live camera feeds for spec ops, commanders at base to see what they were doing. He also told me they wore what was called spider armor, which was thin, lightweight plates and bodysuit that covered vital organ parts that could move quickly and be well protected. He'd been shot 2 times in the armor, which protected him, but fractured his sternum and so forth. Back to giants. I then asked, after he went on for about 20 minutes of all the ancient things he saw in Iraq and Afghanistan, underground ancient cities and caves, I asked, do you know anything of a recon squad encountering a live giant? He said, you mean giants, plural. He then basically restated the incident you told on Coast to Coast a couple years ago, and the soldier came on to tell about what he knew. And the pilot that flew the giant body that they did bring down, he said one of the lightweight guns didn't do anything. It was a couple of grenades from rifle launchers that finally took it down, but 2 Marines were killed, or torn apart, as he said. 1 other giant escaped. Now, either you can take that as just a bunch of wild, crazy stuff, or that Marine was telling the truth. You understand that the cradle of civilization, folks, is located in the Valley of Mesopotamia. The word Mesopotamia means the valley between the rivers, the Tigris and Euphrates rivers. The first thing they teach you when you start studying geography and ancient history is that that's where Abraham came from, folks. He came from Ur of the Chaldees, and that's where he came from Iraq. So it's ancient. It's old. It was old when Christopher Columbus sailed the ocean blue in 1492. That place was ancient. And they're talking about encountering in caves underneath Saddam's palaces and place like that, giants. Now, there's no question in my mind that giants have lived. There is an abundant amount of information and proof that they have lived. But it's a remarkable thing now you're beginning to find out how the government is beginning to cover up a lot of what's going on when we deal with this. You remember what Henry Ford said? He said history, and I'm not exactly sure if I can quote him verbatim, and I'm not exactly sure what he meant by all of it. But he said history, for the most part, I guess what he meant by it, was bunk. In plain words, what's commonly referred to as the historical progression of time and man's relationship to it and the way all this stuff is laid out, as far as Henry Ford was concerned, it was just a bunch of garbage. So what does that mean? Well, that means that there's been a systematic effort to keep you in the dark and to change your perspective on what's happening in the world and how it came to pass, how you got here. Now, if you're a Bible believer, you believe the Bible, first of all, right? I mean, you do. You believe the Bible. And I've always loved history. I loved history. Always have, still do. I love history. Some folk bore them to death. I can go into museums and read history books and just get lost. I love it. And because of the fact that history is so relevant for where you are right now, have you been told the truth? There are certain events in history that's undeniable, especially when you come to modern history. But I mentioned to you a man by the name of Herodotus. He lived about 200-300 years before Christ. He's called the father of history. Here's the reason. Because he systematically arranged together the facts as he knew them to that date and tried to lay down an order of progression in man's history and how other things related to it. All right, well, that's good. That's what a historian does. And Herodotus goes back a long way, folks, 2,300 years. All right. Now, we know a lot of history has taken place since then. But now think about it. Herodotus is dated at about 300 B.C. When did Abraham live? I've told you 1,000 times. 1,900 years before Christ. Moses was 1,400 years before Christ. David was 1,000 years before Christ. 586 B.C., they were carried off into Babylonian captivity. 722 B.C., into Assyrian captivity. 4,002 B.C., according to Archbishop Usher, man was formed from the dust of the ground. These are general times, but they help you get things in perspective. All right. We're looking at 1,600 years before Herodotus, Abraham lived. A lot can happen in 1,600 years, right? You better believe it. A lot can happen. So the bottom line is, I'm not saying Herodotus was trying to deceive anybody. I'm not at all. Because the fact of the matter is, you go back and start reading these ancient historians, they talk about giants just as freely as we're in here this morning talking. Josephus and Caesar, for example. You read about Caesar and his trips out fighting against the Gauls and the Germans. I mean, he talks about the giants like you wouldn't believe. He doesn't try to cover anything up. So, you know, it's a fact. But the truth, but here's the problem. Today, the philosophy of education is that certain things are immediately swept away because we have what's politically correct, what's accepted. And if it doesn't fit, then get rid of it. Now, what kind of mind is that? A mind that thinks is a mind that'll take it all and say, well, if my theory doesn't fit, God, give me some sense to make it fit. Let's figure out what's going on here. A fellow by the name of Ralph Renier, I think is probably the way you'd pronounce that. I know very little about French, but there's an accent on the E, so it's probably Renier. This man just passed away a few years ago. Very, very brilliant man. Deals with all areas, not only history and archaeology, but he deals with science. He's very good at it. But anyway, he takes the position that what you are being taught for the most part is bunk, like Henry Ford. But unlike Henry Ford, this man has a lot of documentation to deal with what he's talking about. Let me give you some instances, just a few. There exists in Sacsayhuaman, Peru, an intricately carved monolithic stone pyramid. Monolithic means one stone. The thought that this single piece of monolithic stone was dragged over hill and dale from a distant quarry is mind-boggling. But even more unbelievable is the huge thing is now upside down in the ground. Now he's building upon something, and what he's building upon is the fact that these ancient people were able to move huge stones that today, with equipment we have a hard time dealing with what these people dealt with. Who are they? Who can do this? Well, if you're a 36-foot tall giant, you wouldn't have much trouble with it. Surrounding this site are 60-foot high stone walls whose stones have been ground one to the other in situ. They are so precise that not even a knife blade can be inserted between them. One of these wall stones weighs 200,000 tons. All right, that's 200,000 times 2,000. And this 400 million pound block of stone was apparently quarried over 200 miles away. Now just wrap your mind around that for a minute. Could it be they knew more than that folks give them credit for? Ruins like this are found everywhere on every continent. Are called antediluvian, meaning they were built before the mythical flood. Now he puts it in parentheses as if to say this is what they say, not that I mean it. In other words, you understand. When you quote somebody, it just doesn't mean that you're necessarily agreeing with it. You're just quoting them. They're also referred to as cyclopean structures because of a race of huge cyclops were thought to have erected them. Now, I got to move quickly because I want to cover some things here that you definitely need to hear. The Titanic, weighed a mere 45,000 tons. Slipped on the waves during construction, it took the shipbuilders using modern derricks, whenever Titanic was built, using modern derricks and hydraulic jacks over a month to straighten out the problem. 1979, behind the dam site at Abu Simbel, when they built that dam down there and they dammed up the Nile River, they covered up a lot of ancient Egyptian tombs and artifacts. In 1979, behind the dam site at Abu Simbel, the Egyptians tried to move an 80-foot statue to a new location, found that modern equipment wasn't equal to the task. They left it to be submerged. And on it goes. Now listen to this. Listen carefully. On the shores of Lake Titicaca, there exists the lost city of I'll butcher these names. Tiahuanaco, I guess is the name. The lake is now 12,644 feet above sea level. Let me say something right here before we go further. First thing I learned when I got a pilot's license was if you get above 10,000 feet, you'd better have oxygen because your body will begin to be depleted of oxygen and you'll go into vertigo. You'll lose your orientation and you'll think you're upside down when you're not. You'll lose you can't fly, you can't read your instruments, you can't coordinate, you'll die. They had a city at 12,000, are you listening? 12,644 feet above sea level. Imagine how thin the air was. Burlett says it is, quote, too high for corn to grow, for cats to live, for white women to give birth, whatever that means, and certainly too high for a population large enough to have built and carved the enormous stones that comprise the city. To quickly cut to what he says, he says that this city may very well have been raised up from a previous level because it's got a port. There are no ships sailing at 13,000 feet. So what was the purpose of the port? The purpose of the port, obviously, was for docking of ships. So what does that mean? That means that this area at one time was down at sea level, and something tremendous pushed it up into the air. And what would that be, folks? I mean, over and 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 over, ad nauseum, time and time and time and time again, they find in ways that you wouldn't even think related, proof of the flood. Yeah. But in any event, That's an issue. You ought to check that out for yourself. Lake Titicaca down there in... people pay thousands of dollars to go down and see that. I've seen photographs of it. It's quite a remarkable place. They have freshwater sharks that live in that lake and seahorses in that lake. In 3000 B.C., the Egyptians knew how to do exchange electroplating to plate antimony on copper vessels. They placed antimony sulfide in a solution of vinegar and salt in a container and then inserted the copper to be plated. That's not a stone man. 40 years ago, I saw a color photo of a wooden box been found in Iraq labeled Mysterious Object. The boards had been coated and caulked with pitch, and there were two wide green-blue slashes of color down one side. Not being a philosopher, I had no trouble in identifying this mysterious object. I had just built a quite similar one for a customer. It took the experts about 10 more years before they decided this was a plating tank and that the flask-shaped clay bottles found adjacent to the tank were batteries. 2,000 years old. The objects, 2,000 years old, had been discovered by a German archaeologist in a dig outside Baghdad in 1937, had been stored away all the years. The bottles each held an iron rod, that's a conductor, which was inside a copper cylinder. In 57, an American scientist made an exact replica, poured in vinegar. The result was an electric battery. They used electricity. The separation of aluminum from bauxite without electricity is a very difficult chemical process, but ancient aluminum trinkets have been found in China. It even seems the ancient Greeks had a word for it. A Chinese general was buried with an alloy girdle that was composed of 85% aluminum. They had to purify it. Platinum has a very high melting temperature. I looked to find out. Mild steel melts at 2,700 degrees Fahrenheit. I wanted to find out what, if he said, how high do you have to get to melt platinum? 3,200 and something degrees to melt platinum. It takes 500 degrees more heat to melt platinum than it does mild steel. And, you know, you don't just build a fire out here, folks. You don't just build a fire out here, wood fire. You're not going to melt steel. Build you wood fire, get you a bonfire going as hot as you can, and it'll turn red hot and cook everything you want to on it, and that steel will still be standing there. That's why there's so many people that have a problem with those World Trade Towers coming down. They still have never seen a steel building collapse under a fire like those buildings did up there, those World Trade Towers. It still hasn't happened. A steel building, I'm talking about the structure of the building. I'm not talking about the facade, the very structure of the building. If it's built out of steel, you can burn it and it'll still be standing there. The steel's not going down. You got to get 2,700, you got to have a blowtorch. You have to have some way of intensifying the heat. And look at platinum, 3,200 degrees. How could they get that kind of temperature 2,000 years ago? Think about it. It makes no sense at all if you follow the commonly accepted. Now, this one will blow your mind. 1988, a small wooden model is discovered at Saqqara in an Egyptian tomb, dated at about 200 B.C., 2,200 years ago. It was placed in a wooden box labeled Wooden Bird Model, stored in the basement of the Cairo Museum until Dr. Masiha discovered it was actually a model airplane that could fly. Did you get that? 2,200 years ago, a little model airplane that could fly. Where did the knowledge come from? See, that's the issue. That's what you got to think about. Where did this knowledge come from? Why all of a sudden is this burst, this increase in knowledge? Book of Daniel says that knowledge shall increase, doesn't it? It's talking about the age in which you live. There have been leaps and bounds in technology now. When DNA was discovered by Crick and a lady they say was the one who really discovered it, but Crick got all the accolades for it. Discovered DNA that it's almost like it's like the afterburner that hits when a jet takes off. He's got what's called an afterburner, and that really gives him another boost in power. That's what DNA did. It's the afterburner that kicked in. Well, I want to read this one for you because I've mentioned it time and again. The most publicized human fossil footprints in the bedrock of the Paluxy River in Glen Rose, Texas. How many's heard of that? I've seen photographs. I've got photographs in books. I've seen pictures of these tracks frozen in the rocks ages ago. The first thing your eye attracts are the 30-inch wide prints of a web-footed dinosaur who was apparently going about his business. But then you realize the overlaid moccasin-clad feet were going about the business of stalking old Webfoot. To give scale to the picture, the photographer placed a 12-inch ruler alongside of the human's prints. The book also reported that, as usual, the paleo-philosophers, who were much too busy to examine the site, had agreed in absentia that the tracks were fraudulent. Then, as now, they were absolutely sure that 100 million years separated the first man from the last dinosaur. No one ever explained the fraud, and the years roll by. See how it works? It doesn't fit their theory. They didn't even bother to check it out. They just called it fraudulent, or this or that, or what have you. That's their mindset. The Bible said for this, they are willingly ignorant. Now listen what happens though. A few years ago, a group of fanatics whose literal belief in the Bible caused them to believe the earth was created only 10,000 years ago. I'm one of those fanatics. Entered the Paluxy River Valley. To prove this contention, they made a film called, appropriately enough, Footprints in Stone. A literal belief in the Bible would, of course, make man the dinosaur contemporary neighbors. Yes, it would. Yes, it would. Then Glenn J. Kuban showed up, according to John Nobel Wilford, who reported the incident, June 17, 1986, New York Times. Mr. Kuban, an expert on dinosaur tracks, first found the Paluxy River was real. Next, Mr. Kuban discovered that the rocks were real, and later the webfoot tracks cast in those whitish rocks were likewise real. This is the expert, their expert. With the stage thus set for his greatest discovery, he proceeded to find that the man prints, which showed separate left and right feet, were not what they seemed to be. They were really the tracks of a completely unknown three-toed, if flat-footed, dinosaur. They've created something now out of thin air to make these footprints match. They were made by a gay saurian tiptoeing through the tulips while leaving crystal clear heel marks cast. This man's not a Christian writing this thing. He is a, he's not writing from a Christian perspective, which makes it more believable. He's writing it from the perspective of a researcher who's rejected completely the status quo. And so he goes, while leaving crystal clear heel marks cast in white rock and subliminal toe prints cast in rusty and blue-gray rock. The story gets better. At first, Kuban's peers, other paleontologists, refused to believe him since he is a computer programmer by day, a student of weird tracks only by night. The philosophers were bothered by a few things, like the different colored rock in the toes prints and by the fact that no other flat-footed, three-toed dinosaur or bird has ever been found. Still, Mr. Kuban persisted and found completely logical and scientific reasons to explain away their fears. Some of the human tracks were made by the snouts and tails of other dinosaurs as they also strolled about. Never mind the absence of their tracks. They were lightweights. The different culling of the rocks and so forth and so on and so forth and so on. Anything but believe what their eyes are looking at because it does not fit the orthodox view, where men and dinosaurs were separated by millions of years. No, they weren't. They lived alongside each other. This one is amazing. There are old stone fortifications whose surfaces have been in part vitrified. Now, this brings in an element that you wouldn't know what it means, and I didn't know what it meant until I looked it up. What is vitrification? It's this. When intense heat is intense, I'm talking about the heat that would be produced by a nuclear blast. We're talking about millions of degrees of heat is applied to stone or object like that. It forms a surface like glass. And the only way that can be formed is by that kind of heat. All right. Now, in plainer words, a nuclear, something that has the capacity to produce that kind of heat. Their old stone fortification surfaces have been in part vitrified, turned to glass, as in a kiln, or as if they were at ground zero in an atomic bomb test. The process requires extreme heat. Listen carefully. There's a tunnel in solid rock in Vail, Oregon, shaped like a Quonset hut, that is over 40 feet in height. That's awful high, isn't it? It has vitrified walls and goes straight into a mountain. How far? Who knows? The government sealed off the area the night it was discovered over 30 years ago. The picture was published in a now extinct newspaper, The Morning Call, from Paterson, New Jersey. The government came in and immediately shut it down. Just like when anything is found, they shut it down. They shut it down. And then there's all the feet. You know, a footprint has to be preserved. If you step in mud and go back a year later where you stepped in the mud, your print won't be there, because the rains will wash it away and it'll be gone. It has to be, some catastrophic event has to take place that seals that footprint, like a flood. Well, they found them everywhere, running footprints, sealed, all of a sudden, all over the earth. Yes, sir. Well, this guy does. This is right. This is.
Well, a couple other courses did that also. And in ancient Greece, the philosophers were the poets.
Yeah.
That's what talks about Acts 17, the Sermon on Your
Poets. Yeah.
Also written.
Yeah.
They were used interchangeably. The poets were the ones who developed the mythology that was the.
They certainly did, because they're the ones who created the gods. Oh, he is. Oh, absolutely. In 1929, the remnants of a mastodon were found 22 feet down under Stanford College, at the same level that a human skull was previously found. The bones are thought to be 2 to 3 million years old, which would make the skull the same age, so forth and so on. Let me say this for you, and this is my position when I read of millions of years. I just take it and throw it out the door. Because uniformitarianism, which is the doctrine of selective evolution, Charles Darwin's theory, demands millions and millions and millions of years to bring about what's happened. I've showed you enough right here this morning to let you know that the history of the world is entirely different than what you're going to get from the standard production. But what you will find, that if you take the Bible and start reading the Bible, that it in no way disagrees with what I just read to you. The Bible gives a catastrophic event that took place, and that catastrophic event is the flood, and it's a universal flood, and that flood covered the entire world. And when it did, it wiped out the giants, but it didn't wipe them out forever. And so now we get into the issue of what's going on right now. What's happening while I speak, this very moment, this morning? Dr. Chris Winter, who heads up the research team, boasted that in 3 decades... would be the end of death. By combining this information with a record of the person's genes, we could recreate a person physically. What record? They're talking about now the ability to insert within the eye a camera with a computer chip that is capable of recording every movement and every sound that the individual makes. And so therefore, then they can clone that individual. And you know the cloning that's going on by DNA. When they discovered DNA, then that opened the door for cloning. They can clone that individual and essentially perpetuate that person's life forever. Now, that body will eventually die that they were already in because they can't keep the body alive forever. But the identity of the person is supposed to be able to, is to be transferred from one generation to the next generation to the next generation. The idea is that man is constantly at work to try to circumvent the curse of sin that's been brought down on mankind. And he's not going to do it. It's appointed to men once to die, and then the judgment. But here is one of the reasons for all the genetic engineering. Listen to what they've done to mice. This is quite a remarkable thing. Quite a remarkable thing. A scientist wrote in the science journal Nature, we disrupted the GDF-8 gene by gene targeting in mice. Mice lacking the gene are significantly larger than wild-type animals and show a large and widespread increase in skeletal muscle mass. Individual muscles of mutant animals weigh 2 to 3 times more than those of wild-type animals. What are you talking about? I'm talking about the fact that they are experimenting with genetic engineering. First they start with the animals, then they go to humans. And the genetic engineering is literally getting into the code of physical life. Your body is coded. DNA is a code, folks. That double spiral helix is coded. It's connected, too. That double spiral is connected. It's passing information back and forth at the speed of light all the time. They're learning more and more and more about what's happening. And the more they learn, the more dangerous it becomes. Because that means that they put their hand into it and begin to alter it, you know, all for the betterment of mankind. Whatever the utopian dream might be has nothing to do with the fact of reality. I know what man is, and I know what he's going to do. And whatever method Satan uses, whatever method he uses, he will definitely, he's already prepared this country and this world for a spiritual intervention, and they're ready for it. They're ready. Whatever method he chooses is at his door now. It's there. And you are just now beginning to see the beginning of the kind of world it's going to be in 5 to 10 years down the road. This madman kills these people out here in Vail, Colorado. Not Vail, what is it? Aurora, Colorado. And some nutball up here says, essentially, well, he's nothing compared to me. I'm the real Joker. And begins to threaten people. And it's beginning to, it's what it does, it awakens the demonic spirit out here in these people. A man was standing in line 2 days ago. Some fella said something or something happened or he didn't like what went on. He took his knife out and stabbed him. Standing in line. Post office, I think, or something. Some nothing. Yet he jerked that knife out and he stabbed the man. People are living on the edge. And you need to understand that. They have a facade of civility, but underneath they are monsters. They're demons. They're demon-possessed. It's a beautiful world out there when you look at the trees and the rivers and the lakes and the streams and the mountains and the flowers. They haven't changed. But the people that inhabit this world are nothing like they were just 10 years ago. Is it ready for the Antichrist? You better believe it is. It's ready. It's ready. We'll pick it up again next week. And Lord willing, move along with this. All right, let's have a word of prayer. We'll let you go. Brother Valance, dismiss us, please.